walking on it, only this covered his whole body. Still he pushed through. He was ready to see his father again, to be reunited. His dad's face started to coalesce before him. Worry filled it. "Dad?" Jeff wondered. "Aren't you happy to see me? Didn't I make you proud?" Then he saw why the worry was there. If Jeff was up here, if Jeff had left Mars and succumbed to oxygen deprivation, then David was alone. David was back there, and Jeff had promised his father he'd never let that happen. A deep pit formed under Jeff and swallowed him. He tumbled through space and time. The light grew farther away, then it suddenly exploded. "Jeff!" David cried. David was shaking Jeff. He shone his helmet-mounted lights in Jeff's face. A second passed before Jeff realized the helmet wasn't on David's head, though. David had it under his arm.
What?
Jeff coughed. His throat was scratchy, and his head pounded like a sentinel was stomping on it.
"What's going on?"
"You're alive," David said. Tears streamed from the corners of the boy's eyes. He pulled Jeff into a tight hug, crying and laughing at the same time.
"You're alive!"
The laughter and tears were contagious, and Jeff returned his brother's embrace with equal vigor. He was alive. He wouldn't fail his dad now. Not after he'd been given a second chance. Then reality hit him with a force that nearly knocked him backward.
"We've got to be quiet," Jeff said, stifling his laughter and tears at once.
David grinned and pulled away from Jeff.
"It's okay."
"What do you mean, it's okay?" Jeff said.
"They can't hear us in here," David said proudly.
"Here?" Jeff tried to stand, but found his knees were too wobbly. He used the glimmer of David's helmet lights to locate a gleaming silver table and pulled himself up.
"What is this place?"
"It's the lab next to Biome One," David said excitedly.
"Well, not really the whole lab."
He shone his light about the place. The beam reflected off big silver lab tables and all kinds of microscopes and instruments Jeff didn't recognize. The space reminded Jeff of the types of labs he saw in zombie movies where some hero scientist was trying to find a cure.
"We're in the isolated lab," David said.
"Isolated?" Understanding washed over Jeff.
"Oh, the isolation lab."
From their time in the biosphere on Cheyenne Mountain, he remembered exploring the facilities and asking all kinds of questions of Holly, Sophie, Bauma, and Emmanuel. This particular lab was where they stored all their sensitive laboratory supplies, like cells and chemicals. Stuff the scientists said had to be carefully monitored.
"Yeah, the isolation lab," David said. "On Cheyenne, Emmanuel told us the isolation lab had its own air supply to protect the experiments. He also said it had special walls to protect against radiation and stuff. I figured if it had its own air supply and it could protect against radiation and things, that maybe it would still be working."
"And it is?" Jeff asked.
"Kind of,"
David said.
"Our suits have already recharged their oxygen supplies, but this place doesn't look real great."
He pointed to a darkened display panel on the bulkhead. The display hung off by a few wires, and a message emblazoned in red blinked across it. "Emergency power activated," the sign said.
"I wonder how long we can stay here," Jeff said.
David shrugged. Jeff wandered toward the display and pressed his hand against it. The display lit up and he jumped back, startled that it actually worked. A vaguely human shape appeared. The apparition flickered in and out of existence.
"Jeffrey, David,"
Sonya's voice came out in a garble.
"I believe the others will be glad to hear that you have survived."
Jeff's heart raced at a million beats a minute at the sound of that.
"They're alive? Where are they?"
David joined him, practically jumping next to him.
"Sophie and Emmanuel, Bauma and Holly."
"I cannot confirm that they are still alive,"
Sonya said. Her voice faded with her image.
"But they left the ship to search for you too. I uploaded a copy of myself to their systems. Their goal was to find you first within the colony.
At once Jeff's shoulders sagged. He felt all the hope leave him, like air flowing from a popped balloon.
So you don't know if they're alive? I do not currently,
Sonya said.
Probabilities are low, but according to the radio signatures, I can still detect the organics are mobilizing again. Based on their formations, I believe they are searching for something. Pattern analysis of today's events leads me to postulate that they are searching for the others.
Then maybe they really are still alive, Jeff said. We've got to find them first, David said. We've got to go.
I am afraid that will not be possible,
Sonya said.
Few vehicles escaped the damage caused by our skirmish above Mars, and those that did were destroyed when the plasma reactor failed. The only working transport units in the vicinity are those of the organics.
What are we going to do, Jeff?
David asked. Jeff had been given a second chance. David had saved his life. Sophie and the others had saved both of them time and time again. It was time for Jeff to return the favor. If the organics were going after them, he would have to either warn them or help them somehow. He knew they couldn't live forever in this cramped lab in the middle of the desolate ship. They had to get out of here.
Jeff?
David asked again. Jeff clapped his brother on the back and puffed out his chest. What he was about to suggest was crazy, but what other choice did they have?
Bud, we're going to hitch a ride with the aliens.
Then he looked at the monitor where Sonya was.
You want to come with?
Athena drove down another street covered in debris. The green SUV's oversized off-road tires handled well, despite the same scene of destruction. Broken windows, vehicles tossed haphazardly like toys, and litter covered the roads.
If there were spiders or other aliens out there, she didn't see any of them. She kept her foot on the pedal and squinted to see through the cracked windshield. Another pass from the wipers streaked over the glass, removing a layer of dust and opening up a view of the road.
"You see anything?"
she asked Trish.
The officer shook her head from the passenger seat.
She gripped her pulse rifle tightly against her chest. In the back seat was Taylor, his helmet turned toward the rear window. Ahead, the black van Griffin drove turned right down another street. Malone was riding shotgun. Fitting the entire GOA crew in these two vehicles would be a tight squeeze, but that was only if everyone decided to come. Her gut told her Posey was staying. Athena checked the gauges of their truck a third time. The fuel cell was almost fully charged. Despite sitting in that garage for months, that should be more than sufficient to get them to Pelican AFB if they weren't driven out of their way by organics. They were almost out of the city when she saw the first evidence of the monsters. Athena knew the fresh markings on the sides of the buildings all too well. Only the spiders could climb vertically.
"Eyes up,"
she said quietly. Trish craned her helmet for a better look. Griffin drove toward the turnoff at the end of the street. A wall of sand blocked part of their escape route, but the beaches were only a block away.
"Come on,"
Athena whispered, gripping the steering wheel.
"I think I see something,"
Taylor said. Athena looked in the rearview mirror to check their six when sand exploded from the mound at the end of the street. Trish let out a scream as spiders burst out from the dune. Griffin swerved to the right to avoid them, but the beasts were fast. Two took to the exterior of the building, skittering across to flank the van while the other three scampered toward Athena's truck.
"Watch out!"
Trish shouted. Athena considered taking a left and trying to outrun the beasts, but she gunned the engine instead, heading right for the trio.
"What are you doing?"
Taylor yelled.
"Hold on!"
Athena increased her grip on the steering wheel, staring the aliens down.
"Come on, you bastards!"
One of the spiders abandoned the charge at the last minute, jumping out of the way, but the other two darted right for the hood. She gave the engine more juice and plowed into them with enough force that both their shields flickered off in a flash of blue light. Metal crunched into the fragile organic flesh. painting the road with gooey blue blood. The right tire thumped over a skull. The crack echoed, and the vehicle jolted from the impact.
"Woo-hoo!"
Athena yelled. Her excitement drained at the sound of the third spider jumping onto the roof of the vehicle. Razor-sharp claws sank through it, and the beast pulled a sheet of metal back. The alien then stabbed at Trish, its talons slicing into the passenger seat headrest. Athena yanked Trish forward while Taylor opened fire with his pulse rifle. The rounds punched through metal and ricocheted off the shield, knocking the creature forward. Athena swerved again, slamming into the side of an upside-down truck. The impact knocked the spider off the top and onto the hood. It scrambled to recover, but she slammed on the brakes, throwing the beast onto the street. She then punched the pedal to the floor, accelerating again, and slammed into the creature, sending it skidding across the road. The monster smashed against a building, and its carapace cracked, letting loose a flood of oozing blood. Griffin's van had stopped ahead, Malone standing outside it with an RPG launcher ready. He got back inside when he saw Athena had dealt with the problem. The van was moving by the time she reached it, and they drove side by side down the final stretch and out onto the beaches. Wind rushed through the fresh hole in their roof. Taylor moved out of the sunlight and in between the front two seats. "Nice driving, Corporal," he said. Trish nodded. "Yeah, nice driving." "You okay?" Athena asked Trish. A nod. Athena reached up to move the rearview mirror, which now hung from several cords. "Good shooting," Athena said. "Sorry," Taylor replied. "Make sure we're not being followed." Taylor pivoted to look out the back window as Los Angeles receded into the distance. "Doesn't look like it." The report still didn't slow Athena's pounding heart. They had been lucky, really lucky. But how much longer would their luck hold up? She laid off the gas when she realized the van was falling behind. The van's tires weren't designed to travel on the sand like this, but they were holding up for now. Malone raised a hand from the lowered passenger window, then pointed at the skyline across the hood. Athena followed his finger toward a pair of drones and three alien fighters. "Oh, shit," she whispered. She slammed on the brakes and skidded to a stop, pushing up a small wall of sand. Griffin parked the van next to them. They killed the engines and watched in silence as the aircraft roared through the blue sky.
I don't think they're heading our way," Trish said. Athena studied the aircraft. She hadn't seen this many out here before, and their presence told her something was happening. But Trish was right. They weren't heading toward Los Angeles. "What the hell are they doing?" Trish asked, echoing Athena's thoughts. "I'd have assumed they would be checking out reports from the ground troops in L.A., but there must be something more important going on," she replied. "What's more important than two vehicles with armed human soldiers?" Taylor asked from the back seat. "I don't know, but I'll take it," Athena said. She fired the engine back up and signaled for Griffin to do the same. The alien ships vanished over the horizon heading northeast. Perhaps there were other survivors fighting back and actually making some headway out there. "We can only hope." Athena drove back to the GOA with hope in her heart. For the first time in months, they had working transport and a plan. The time for living in the dreary guts of the sub was over. The time to find a new home was now. She almost grinned as they drove the final mile, but the half-smile faded when she saw what remained of the dune covering the submarine. Her heart pounded in her chest. The storm had exposed the entire starboard side of the GOA. "Oh, no,"
Trish whispered. Taylor moved between the front two seats again for a better look. Athena parked next to the van and everyone jumped out. The wind whistled over her armor as she ran toward the submarine. At the base, she stopped next to Griffin. Scratch marks covered the hull, looking like the scars made by a giant squid on the belly of a sperm whale. Griffin shouldered his RPG launcher and followed Malone and Taylor around the side of the long, partially buried submarine. Trish and Athena followed close behind, their pulse rifles up.
"Are those?"
Trish asked, not finishing her sentence. They climbed up what remained of the sand slope on the right side of the GOA. Griffin had stopped there and balled his hand. He turned to Athena as she began to crest the top of the hill.
"Corporal, don't come up here,"
he said. She pushed past him even as he held up an arm to stop her.
"We have to get back to the trucks,"
Malone said to Taylor. Athena gasped when she saw the graveyard in the sand on the other side of the submarine. Over a dozen bodies were sprawled out, dark stains of dried blood surrounding each. The organics hadn't even bothered to turn her crew into orbs. They had simply slaughtered them and left them to waste. She closed her eyes and lowered her helmet, despair gripping her so hard she felt like she was going to pass out. "Corporal," came Griffin's sharp voice. She ignored him and opened her eyes to look back out over the bodies. These people weren't just crew. They were family, and now they were all dead. You couldn't save them.
"Corporal, we need to gather up supplies and move before those things return," Griffin said.
Athena swallowed, and a thin tear crept down her face. She sucked in a deep breath and turned to face the final four members of her crew. Their mirrored visors all focused on her, but she was busy looking at the sky to make sure the aliens weren't returning. She saw the direction on her HUD, northeast.
"Where do you think they're going?"
Taylor asked.
"I don't..."
Athena let the words trail off. There was so little of the human world left, she couldn't imagine what it was they were after. What could possibly pose a threat that warranted them abandoning their attack on her and her crew? Maybe there was another group of survivors out there striking back at the aliens? If there was, wouldn't Alexia have told her?
"Oh, shit," Athena muttered.
Colorado was directly along the organics' projected path, according to her HUD. Their route would intersect with Cheyenne Mountain. They were going for Alexia.
Entry 10205, designee AI Alexia. I detect 24 alien ships en route to Cheyenne Mountain. If I were a human, I might laugh at how well my distraction worked, and then I would probably cower in fear. But I'm not human. I'm an artificial intelligence tasked with saving the lives of those that created me. Lo-Lo shows I'm doing just that. Corporal Athena Rollins and her crew are making their way across the sands to the Pelican AFB, while every organic ship in the area bolts toward my location. The ground rumbles inside the biosphere, shaking the walls. I switch to the feed on the tarmac outside, where Dr. Sophie Winston first arrived by NTC helicopter. The pad is now filled with sharks. Sentinels are already slithering toward the blast doors. A dozen drones hiss by the mountain to check out the location of the missile launchers, the empty launchers, rather. The creatures will have to put up a formidable effort to get inside the mountain. As long as I can keep them from my hard drive, I should be able to continue operating from this location. The sentinels pause outside the blast door to examine it. I'd run a scan to determine what their next moves will be. The sentinels begin retreating to their aircraft. The aliens appear ready to bombard the blast door with their laser cannons. Wait. One of the sentinels drops a soccer ball-sized object near the blast door before following the other aliens to the tarmac. The ball is covered in spikes and slowly rolls along the edge of the door. I zoom in just as the ball breaks into 100 smaller spheres, 120 to be exact. They are the size of gumballs, and they move away from the blast door. My cameras follow them over a cliff and down the mountainside. I do not understand their purpose, but I have what the humans would call a gut feeling. These strange spheres seem wildly dangerous. I cannot let them penetrate the biosphere. If the organics destroy me, then they doom every surviving human on the planet. They must be stopped. The robot army I've constructed is my best and only shot at doing just that. I send signals to all my bots, both inside and outside the biosphere. Move out and engage the foreign invaders. The video feed shows all the robots responding to the command. In a few minutes, I'll see how well I've planned for this moment. The fate of Corporal Athena Rollins and hundreds of other humans rests in the hands of robots designed to clean floors and scan brains. End entry.
Emmanuel felt the world shift under his feet.
He stood staring at the organic ship within the vehicle hold of the Shekundo Kasu.
The mystery of why it was here and what the hell it was doing inside a human ship suddenly seemed unimportant. "You've got one organic ship headed our direction?" Emmanuel asked Sonya. "Are you sure?"
"I am no longer sure,"
Sonya said.
"What do you mean?"
Diego asked. The three soldiers, Sophie and Emmanuel, were all frozen.
"I no longer have the same confidence in the likelihood that there is a single organic ship coming toward us."
"So then we're in the clear," Ort said. "No organic ships."
"No, That is not correct either,
Sonia said. Balma spoke slowly, anger lacing his voice. Sonia, how many ships have you detected coming this way?
Six.
A weight pulled at Emmanuel's insides. How long until they are here? He asked.
At their current speed, 15 minutes.
Shit, Ort said. We've got to get out of here.
The soldier started moving for the exit. What about the colony's location? Emmanuel said.
We just finished securing the ship, Diego said. We haven't secured a hard link for Sonia to rake through any data.
Sophie looked between the exit and the organic ship. A pained expression crossed her face. We've got to know where the colony is. Hoffman would have left some intel on this ship, wherever they were headed.
Shit,
Balma said. You all head to the Rhino. Get ready to leave. I'll get a hard uplink in place. If there's something on this ship, I want you guys to have it.
You're coming with us, Balma, Emmanuel said. We aren't leaving without you.
I know. But the expression on his face seemed to indicate otherwise.
You're not doing this alone, Diego said. Balma shook his head and pointed at the exit to the vehicle hold. Holly and the kids are out there. Protect them. Protect the two doctors.
He didn't give Emmanuel or Diego time to protest before sprinting away and disappearing into a corridor.
Damn it, Diego said. Fine. Everyone on me.
Emmanuel took a final look at the organic ship. Something about the vessel still bothered him. It was unlike the others they'd seen. Smaller, certainly, but that wasn't it. Sophie grabbed his arm. We've got to go. They fell in line with Diego and Ort. They plunged back into the darkness of the corridors. Once outside, they were met with a landscape as calm and seemingly untouched as before. There was no light glinting over the horizon to give away the location of the approaching organic ships. No dust cloud rose into the sky from ground troops stampeding toward them. But, of course, by the time Emmanuel noticed such things, it would already be too late. When they burst into the Rhino, Holly already had the children strapped in their seats.
"Where's Balma?"
she asked when Ort slammed the hatch shut.
Diego and Ort jumped into the front seats and began warming the Rhino's motors. "He's installing an uplink for Sonia in the Secundo Caso,"
Emmanuel said.
"We're not leaving here without him, right?"
she asked.
"Not if we don't have to," Diego said.
Holly's bottom lip trembled. She did not seem to like that answer.
"Balma, you asshole. You better make it back to the Rhino."
"Don't you worry," Balma's voice crackled over the comms. Then a moment later, "We got the uplink installed." "Get out here now, soldier," Diego said. "Sonia can take care of the rest."
Sophie sat in one of the passenger seats next to a display panel.
Her face appeared flushed again and the whites of her eyes appeared red.
"Everything okay?" Emmanuel asked. He felt stupid asking it. He knew the answer. Of course she wasn't okay. But what else could he say right then?
"I'm feeling exhausted," she said.
Her eyes roved over the Rhino's floor toward the R-Vamp.
"Remember what you promised me."
"I can't forget as much as I want to,"
he said, gulping painfully. Then he turned to the display where Sonia appeared.
"Sonia, have you located any data on the NTC colony?"
"There is almost no data on this ship,"
Sonia said.
Emmanuel couldn't believe he'd heard her right. Maybe he'd framed the question incorrectly.
"Did you find any reports regarding the whereabouts of the ship's crew?"
"No,"
Sonia replied simply.
"This information does not exist."
"Can you find another AI on there?" Diego asked.
"No AI exists on the ship's intranet beside my sub-mind,"
Sonia replied.
"What the hell?"
Emmanuel asked. Shadows of an approaching storm were drifting into his mind.
"A missing crew is one thing, but no trace of an AI? What did they do, remove every single drive from this ship?"
"They did not remove the data storage drives,"
Sonia replied.
"All hardware is accounted for. The only active native functions are the communication systems and sensor arrays that we detected previously."
"This doesn't make sense," Sophie said.
Maybe the organics wiped out everything aboard the ship.
Here's a wild thought, Diego said. If we've already got an uplink to the Shakundo Kasu, then why don't we just fly the goddamn ship out of here?
It'll be faster than the Rhino, Hort said.
And as soon as they see that thing lift off, there's no hiding, Sophie said. It looks like they already found it once. Not going to be hard to find it again.
We already know the organic ships are faster, and we don't fare well against them in battle, Emmanuel said. We're better off losing them in the Rhino. Harder to detect, smaller profile, we can hide more easily.
That's a huge assumption, Hort said. They might already have a lock on the Rhino. That's gotta be why they're headed this direction.
Don't know about that, Sophie said. She was holding her head now, as if nursing a hangover. I have a feeling they're more interested in the Shakundo Kasu and the ship they've got stored there. Either that, or they located it the same way we did.
No matter what, we're screwed if we don't get out of here, Diego said. Dama, where are you?
Almost there,
Dama replied. True to his word, he surged out of an exit hatch and ran across the bumpy Martian surface toward the Rhino. Emmanuel breathed a sigh of relief as he watched the soldier approach the vehicle. He wasn't sure he could stand to see another crew member left behind.
Thank you,
Diego said. He initiated the motor's drives and flung open the airlock doors to let Bauma in. Before Bauma found his seat, Diego threw the Rhino into drive. The motors let out their electric hum as the vehicle started to move forward. Then, just as soon, it stopped. The lights went out. Emmanuel's straps bit into his shoulders as the vehicle lurched to a stop.
What's going on? Emmanuel asked.
The Rhino just stopped, Diego said. His fingers worked desperately across the controls. Nothing he was doing seemed to have any effect.
I've lost power to all motors. Sonia, can you restart the Rhino? Emmanuel asked.
He unstrapped himself from his seat and rushed to Diego's side, desperate to help.
Negative, Dr. Rodriguez, Sonia said. I am completely locked out of the vehicle's controls.
Locked out? What do you mean?
Sophie asked.
A malicious program has subverted the Rhino's programming, creating a firewall that I am unable to bypass,
Sonia said. Emmanuel slammed a fist against the Rhino's inner wall.
Where the hell did it come from?
From the Shakundo Kasu.
He opened his mouth, ready to demand how she hadn't noticed it before.
She'd claimed there was nothing left of the data architecture on the Shakundo Kasu.
Then a feeling of dread sank through him. He realized his mistake. She'd said native software. This virus, or whatever it was, wasn't native, nor was it human.
That virus, or whatever it is that stopped us, is from the organics, isn't it? Emmanuel asked.
That is correct,
Sonia said. Compromised as she was, Sonia hadn't mentioned it because they hadn't asked. Too late now.
Looks like we'll have to take the ship after all, Hort said, already standing.
I don't think that's going to be possible, is it? Emmanuel asked, looking back at the display.
Sonia, are you able to power up the Shakundo Kasu's engines?
No, I am not,
Sonia replied.
The same program is preventing you from doing so,
Emmanuel said, unable to keep the defeat from his words.
It is.
Emmanuel looked at the display that showed the approaching organic ships. They would be on them in minutes. Going by foot seemed to be about their only option. But then they'd be run down in a matter of seconds, cut down by the organics before they even got out of sight of the malfunctioning Rhino. There was only one other option that Emmanuel could think of. It seemed insane, but he wasn't sure they had anything to lose at this point.
Sonia, he started. Do you think you can control an organic ship?
Chapter 16
Doc, if this actually works, I'm going to buy you the biggest damn drink on Mars, Bauma said. The others trailed behind him as they abandoned the Rhino. The sky was still full of brilliant stars, and Bauma wondered which of those might be an organic ship waiting to descend on them. His fingers itched for the rifle strapped across his back. But if Sonia was right about how many ships were headed toward them, he doubted a few EMP grenades, R-vamps, and rifles were going to win them any battles.
Turning one of the organics' weapons against them, on the other hand, sounded more promising. At least it offered them a better mode of escape than hoofing it.
They ran back to the vehicle hold of the Shekundo Kasu.
"You know what?" Hort said, his voice rumbling over the comms in their helmets. "I'm getting real sick of this ship already."
"Don't get too sick of it," Emmanuel said. Owen was running beside him, hand in hand.
"If this organic ship can get us out of here, then that's all that matters."
"It was probably something that came from this stupid ship that got us stuck here in the first place," Hort said.
"And you want to try to get it to work now?"
"Look, if that program was meant to subvert human software, it may not have the same effect on organic software, or whatever it is that controls an organic ship," Sophie said. They plunged into the first corridor of the cavernous biosphere ship. Their footsteps echoed noisily in the otherwise quiet structure. "You've got to remember that the organics were probably trying to lock down human technology. They weren't trying to sabotage their own ships." "God, I hope you're right," Holly said, holding Jamie's hand as they ran. Once they reached the vehicle hold, they dashed straight toward the organic ship. The craft sat there, alone in the vast space, taunting them in the near darkness. Blackness, like the shadows around it, covered its hull. Gun barrels jutted from the front of the strange ship like tusks. Emmanuel reached the ship first. He brushed his hand along the side of the smooth hull as he ran toward the forward hatch. Lines were etched into the side of the ship, marking the location of the hatch clearly. To his surprise, a simple tug on the handle-like orifice released the door. The hatch opened the rest of the way automatically, and a short ramp extended down at his feet.
"That's it,"
Emmanuel said, standing frozen before the ship. He took a step back.
"That's what was bugging me about this thing."
Fear suddenly wrapped its icy grip around Balma's heart. He reached for his rifle, pulling it free.
"What is it, Doc?" "The hatch is human-sized," Emmanuel said. "Sure, there are doors big enough for spiders and even a sentinel to get out, but that hatch is perfect for a person. Why would they do that?"
Goosebumps prickled along Balma's flesh. The only human-sized thing he'd ever seen working for the organics was Lieutenant Smith, when her body had been ravaged by nanobots. "Maybe there's some other alien we haven't seen yet," he offered.
"Maybe,"
Emmanuel said.
"Well, are we going to get on this thing or just sit here talking about it?" Diego asked.
He pushed past them and strode into the vessel. Pivoting on his heels, he pointed his rifle into the ship. Suddenly, lights burst to life within it, offering an evanescent azure glow.
"Clear!"
Balma entered the ship next. The blue overhead lights illuminated a cabin that was nearly as dark as the outer hull. Hoses draped from the ceiling looked much like pulsing blood vessels, and consoles sprouted from the bulkhead like they'd grown there. The ship looked more like a living thing than it did a piece of machinery. The others filed in. Holly paused near the hatch. "Should I close it? You think we'll get stuck in here if I do?"
"If we're going to try flying this thing, we've got to shut the door," Balma said.
"Besides, if we get stuck in here, the organics will probably be nice enough to let us out." "Not exactly a scientist over here, but I don't see any data points to make a hard connect," Diego said from what appeared to be the cockpit. Balma joined him in there. "What the hell is this?" The space looked eerily like it had been made for a human crew. There were actual seats and controls that could fit a human ass and human hands, respectively.
What looked to be display panels were positioned in front of two seats in a configuration not so different from what was in the Rhino.
Those seats actually looked inviting. Balma slipped into one.
"Fits just like a glove.
It's like they black cable suddenly protruded from under the seat's headrest. They snaked over his body and pressed him into the chair.
"Balma!"
Diego shouted. But the cables stopped, just short of constricting him.
"I think I'm okay," Balma said.
He gave them a tug for good measure.
"These seem like some kind of automated harnesses."
Trying to test the limits, he threw his body against them. They withstood the sudden movement, but when he tried standing slowly, they loosened and retracted. They seemed to know he was trying to stand and let him.
"This is amazing,"
he said. Before he let himself get too enraptured with the marvels of the strange ship, they had to get the thing flying. "This craft seems to respond to human touch, so, why don't we try touching things?"
Ort raised a brow, but pressed his palm against one of the vacant panels at the front of the ship. The display buzzed to life. A swarm of indecipherable characters scrolled across the screen. Their brilliant sapphire show nearly blinded Bauma. He had to shield his eyes until his pupils adjusted to them.
"Can't read alien," he said. "Can you?"
Sophie joined them in the cabin and leaned over his shoulder. She squinted at the screen. For a second, he thought she might actually be able to decipher it. Maybe those nanobots were doing the work for her.
But she shook her head and leaned back.
"I could just try pressing things again," Ort said.
"Yeah, let's not," Diego said. "Sonya, we could use your help. By the grace of God, do you know if you can connect to the organic ship's computers?"
"There is a live connection from the Shakundo castle to the primitive transport,"
Sonya answered.
"Primitive transport?" Bauma asked. "That's what this ship is called?"
"That is the identifier given to the ship in English by the ship's systems."
"Okay, well, whatever this thing is, can you get this transport moving?"
There was a moment of silence.
"It appears that I can."
"Holy shit, you've got to be kidding," Bauma said. "Strap in, everyone, we're going for a ride."
The others found their seats, and the tentacle-like harnesses secured them in place. If this worked,
Bauma was going to take back all the negative thoughts he'd had about the compromised version of Sonya.
Bauma settled into the pilot's seat and wrapped his hands around the controls.
"Does this thing work like a human ship?"
"No, the engines are quite different,"
Sonya began.
Bauma cut her off before she could continue. "I mean, do the controls steer the ship just like the controls do on our human ships?"
"It would appear to function in a similar manner."
Bauma shrugged. "Close enough. Sonya, how long before contact?"
5 minutes, she said.
"Sonya, can you help me fly this thing?" Bauma asked.
"I can attempt to aid in control management," Sonya said.
Bauma let out a long exhale before mouthing a prayer to himself. "Okay, then feel free to make the attempt. Let's start this thing up."
Nothing happened. "Sonya, that's your cue," Bauma said.
"I am attempting engine startup procedures, but the system is requesting a biological input."
A panel shimmered blue in front of Bauma. The display looked like a thin layer of iridescent water on glass. Part of it gave way, revealing a black shape eerily representative of a human hand.
"I'm assuming that's the input."
He pressed his gloved hand against the screen and held his breath, waiting for the engines to roar to life. Nothing happened.
"Maybe it's like a capacitive screen or something," Emmanuel offered. "You might need skin-to-screen contact."
Bauma stripped off his glove.
"Organic ships are now within 3 minutes of our position,"
Sonya said. His heart was pounding, threatening to climb out of his throat and sprint away across the deck. This had to work. This had to take them out of here. It was absolutely crazy, but he pressed his splayed fingers against the screen. An electric discharge flowed from the screen and into his flesh. An instinctual urge told him to retract his hand, but he couldn't. An invisible force seemed to be holding it there. The fluid-like display rippled like his hand marked the spot where a pebble had been thrown into a pond. A low buzz hummed from the computers in the cockpit, and other lights flashed from displays. Those indecipherable characters continued to flow across all the screens.
"What's going on, Sonya?" Bauma asked.
Sparks of electricity seemed to emanate from his lips, and the world around him began to turn blue. The flow, or whatever it was, coursing through his body warmed his flesh and tightened around his throat.
Oh, God, this was probably not supposed to happen.
Then it all stopped. The electricity seemed to flow right out of Bauma and back into the screen. Whatever force had been holding his hand to the screen let go, and the display went black.
"I am currently deciphering this script to translate the messages I am receiving," she said. There is a key provided by the ship to translate into human language as...
A key?
Sophie asked.
Why would they have a translation key like this?
No one had a good answer for that one, not even Sonya.
I am unsure of the reason for the key's existence,
Sonya said,
but I have translated the failure message.
And?
Velma asked, anxious to try something, anything, to get this transport ship flying.
It appears to have performed a genetic analysis on you,
Sonya said.
While the scan was successful, it detected only human genetic material within your cells. To start this ship, the person who initiates it must have approximately 50% human genetic material and 50% organic-derived genetic material. In simple terms, the person must be a hybrid between human and organic.
The suffering, the constant torture of being thirsty, hungry, and cold, the endless boredom, the mental anguish of knowing he'd lost everything. The torture was almost over now. There would be no more shivering in his orb. There would be no more thinking about his wife and daughters. He wouldn't have to curl up and sob like a filthy, naked animal in his prison. But he wasn't entirely sure that being sacrificed to some alien gods was all that much better. He sat on the freezing floor of the orb, shaking from the cold, and waiting for the conveyor belts to click back to life. There seemed to be a jam somewhere along the line, but Noble couldn't see where, and none of the multidimensional entities were within his line of sight either. The other orbs ahead blocked his view inside the massive pyramid. Ribbit was trying to push himself up, but kept slumping back to the ground. He continued to croak intermittently, but his utterances were getting further and further apart. Ribbit didn't have much time left, but Noble wasn't sure it mattered any longer. Soon they would be sacrificed to the great realm of light, whatever the fuck that meant. His eyes flitted to the curved facade over the entrance to the pyramid, and the hieroglyphics carved into the blue blocks. He wondered what they meant, then just as abruptly decided he didn't give a shit. A blast of light shot out of the pyramid. The usual vibration shook the belt and rocked the orb. Noble steadied himself by holding his arms out. The belt clicked back on, pushing the orbs inexorably toward the entrance of the pyramid. He stood, let his arms fall to his sides, and stiffened his back. If this was it for him, he wasn't going out like a sniveling coward. Captain Rick Noble would show the organics what it meant to be human. "Come on!" he shouted, pounding his chest with a thump. "You want me? Come get me, you fucking assholes!" The curved entrance to the pyramid continued swallowing the orbs ahead. A torrent of rumbles and booms followed. A melancholy alien wail reverberated through the conveyor belt in the respite between the horrifying noises. It lasted for several seconds before silencing. Noble found the sad cry fitting.
"Let's go, assholes!"
he yelled even louder. The curved rim of the entrance flashed blue across the hieroglyphics, giving Noble a vivid view of the different shapes and figures carved into the stone. There were species from Earth, including humans, giraffes, rhinos, sharks. The list went on and on. But there were also alien shapes. Some looked like roots. Others appeared like the gas and puddle creatures from the chamber of the zoo ship. There were also organic spiders and the sentinels. He even saw what Dr. Sophie Winston's team had called a steam beast. There were hundreds and...
"My God,"
he whispered as the belt drew him in. The images and shapes didn't stop on the facade above the doorway. They were carved into every block that made up the 500-story structure. There had to be millions of different aliens represented here. He pushed his palms against the wall of his orb, straining to see, but the pyramid swallowed his prison before he could get a better look. Darkness consumed Noble, but he could still sense motion. His eyes adjusted just a few seconds later,
and he saw blue flames glowing in sconces far across the chamber. This place had to be about a mile long and just as much wide. In the center of the open space, a triangular platform sat directly below the pinnacle of the roof. 8 multidimensional aliens hovered around the raised platform. For the first time, Noble saw their true forms. They were simply a drape of wrinkled, tan skin.
No arms, no legs, no faces.
Just a bedsheet of skin about the height of a man. In the center of the raised platform, a drain emptied goo into the bowels of the pyramid. Spiders standing between the two rows of belts used their talons to pluck orbs off the belts one at a time and then roll them toward the shrine. Working together, the creatures pushed the orbs up a ramp. At the top of the ramp, the orbs were then moved, one by one, onto the center platform, where a metallic clamp held them in place. A brilliant light flashed, liquefying the orb and the prisoner inside instantaneously, before blasting the remains through the opening at the top of the pyramid. To his right, the aliens trapped in the other orbs were all screeching and moving inside their prisons. Each must understand, to some extent, what was about to happen. The gust of energy from the blast slammed into Noble's orb. He crashed into the gooey wall. The skin of the orb came off in his mouth, but he didn't care about the sour taste. He was too focused on the next orb moving up the ramp. Ribbit was pulled off the belt by a pair of spiders. They rolled the ball onto the triangular shrine.
"No!"
Noble shouted.
"You sick fucking pieces of alien shit! Let him go!"
A cackling noise and a crunching came from behind. Noble glanced over his shoulder to see Roots trying to cut his way through the wall of his orb with his twig arms. Noble swallowed hard, and in a fit of rage threw a punch at his orb wall. His fist pushed the thick skin outward.
"Don't hurt him!"
Noble screamed. He pulled his arm back and punched again, and again, and again, until a window opened to the outside world. He reached out with both hands and began prying away the skin, screaming. The other aliens were creating such a ruckus that he couldn't hear anything over the din of grunts, croaks, and otherworldly wails.
"This is a most dishonorable way to acknowledge your contribution to the great realm."
He blocked the multidimensional alien out of his mind.
"Fuck your honor!"
Noble ripped the wall of his orb open, his muscles contracting across his chest. He let out a war cry as he pulled the gooey hide back and stared out over the platform. A dozen spiders all pivoted toward his orb.
"Let Ribbit go!"
Noble shouted. The frog-like alien was standing in its orb on the platform, looking back at Noble with sad black eyes. It let out one last croak before a blast turned the orb and Ribbit to pulp.
"No!"
Noble screamed. He jumped out of his orb and dashed toward the force field surrounding the conveyor belt. To his shock, there was no jolt. Then he realized there was some sort of atmosphere in this building, which must have made using a force field unnecessary. He leapt off the conveyor belt and onto the floor, his naked feet slapping the cold stone as he marched forward. The spiders all watched him, mandibles clicking, apparently unsure what to do. The cackling he had heard earlier was closer now. Roots was pulling itself along behind him, using its wormy legs. He waited for the creature to catch up. The octopus-like face tilted in his direction, and a mouth full of pointy teeth opened to release another cackle.
"Nice to meet you, too," Noble said.
He turned back to the multidimensional creatures, but the skin suits had all vanished. The spiders were moving in, swiping the air with their claws.
"Come on!"
Noble shouted.
"Finish it!"
He raised his fists and pounded his chest, chanting the same mantra.
"Let's go, you assholes!"
The voice from before returned.
"There is no need for this, Captain Rick Noble. You have proven yourself."
He stopped on the platform and looked up just as the entity reemerged above his head,
hovering right above him and Roots. The entity flickered again, hiding its true form.
"You and your friend will now join our ranks."
"What the hell?"
Noble asked. A drone roared into the open doorway and descended over the line of orbs. It veered toward the platform and stopped just above the entity. The multidimensional alien suddenly transformed into a more corporeal form.
"What the hell?"
The alien had simian features, but with feathered wings, a cross between a bird and an ape. It vanished a beat later, and a blue light pulled Noble and Roots into the belly of the drone. Jeff crouched beside David in the corridor of the sunspot. He cradled a rifle, with a spare slung across his back. Patting his suit's zippered pocket, he checked the hard drive they'd stowed the full copy of Sonya on was still there. The screeches of the frustrated spiders sounded far behind them. The aliens must have already scoured the armory and seen the spider Jeff had killed back there. Now they would be spreading out once again to locate Jeff and his brother. Only, this time, Jeff heard a new sound. The ship tremored. Charcoal dust drifted through the air and clung to Jeff's visor. The heavy thump of footsteps sounded from somewhere near the biomes, where Jeff and David had been only moments before. A reptilian roar shook through the space, carried by the thin atmosphere and metal bulkheads into Jeff's suit's speakers.
"It's a sentinel,"
David said.
"Just a sentinel,"
Jeff said, trying to calm his brother. His HUD now said 98% oxygen. Recharging it within the laboratory had done the trick. At least for now. They still had to get past the aliens patrolling the broken sunspot.
"We've killed them before."
"Yeah,"
David said, nodding. A weak smile crossed his face.
"And we'll kill them again."
"That's right,"
Jeff said.
"But most importantly, we've got to get on one of those ships."
David gulped.
"We got this, bud. Remember everything Balma taught us, one step at a time. This isn't our first rodeo with the organics. We can take them."
Jeff hoped his confidence was infectious. The truth was, he didn't feel very confident. At his core, he was frightened by all the organics they had to make it past. The prospect of trying to hide in an organic ship full of them scared him even more. Staying aboard the sunspot wasn't an option, though. There was no food for them here, and no water. They'd eventually run out of oxygen. Somewhere out there, Emmanuel and Sophie and the others were doing their best to escape the organics. Now the aliens were after them, too. Jeff figured getting aboard one of those ships searching for Sophie would be their best chance of reuniting with the rest of the crew. When the organics tried to attack the crew, then Jeff and David could strike. He didn't know what they were going to do yet, but he'd figure it out. Just like he'd figured out how to stay alive and kill the organics all the way back in White Sands. They could do this. The sentinel's heavy footsteps shook the deck. David nearly fell over, but Jeff caught him.
"Careful,"
Jeff said. They snuck through the shadows and recesses of fallen support beams and bent bulkheads. Meter by meter, they crept through the ship's ruins until they made it to a gaping hole in the side of the ship. The hull was nearly 7 decks tall. Jeff towed the edge of it, looking down over the Martian landscape. Spiders and sentinels roamed around. Many of them were streaming back into a couple of the transport ships they'd arrived in. The way they hurried into them worried Jeff.
"Looks like they're loading back up,"
Jeff said.
"They must be in a rush." "Maybe they know where Balma and Holly are,"
David offered.
"We have to hurry too, don't we?"
"That's right, bro."
They scurried down the ladders, past the charred decks. Mangled compartments showed where the crew quarters had once been. Jeff only recognized them based off the cubicle-like walls that had been shredded. There were no beds or blankets left. None of the comforts Jeff and David had enjoyed on their months traveling through space. It had become another home for them, a place where they didn't have to worry about aliens invading a biome. They could sleep and eat and train and play in relative peace. But all that had been shattered when they'd arrived on Mars.
For a brief second, Jeff found himself wishing that they just kept on drifting through space. They could have survived off the food grown in the biomes forever. In his mind's eye, he saw his dad's face again. He'd be disappointed to know Jeff was thinking like that. There were bigger things in the universe than just living on a spaceship like that, no matter how cool it seemed. All the surviving humans on Earth were probably relying on Sophie and the crew to find the colony and convince Hoffman to send back a rescue mission. And maybe there were even bigger and better biomes at the colony. Maybe there were more kids. If they found the hidden colony and fended off the organics, they might have a new world for humans. Mars could be their new home. Whatever was going to happen, they weren't going to be a part of it if they just sat here. They reached the lowest level of the ship undetected. Around them were the remains of the vehicle hold. The rhinos in here were nothing but scrap metal and ash, just like Sonya had said. Transport ships and helicopters were bent and smashed together, crumpled like they were made of nothing but aluminum foil. Jeff shuddered at the thought of the blast that had done that. Then he shuddered again. But it wasn't because of fear. A deafening roar blasted from behind them. The claws of a massive sentinel cut through the air.
Run!
Jeff yelled. The sentinel's claw slammed into the deck where Jeff had stood seconds before. The resulting tremor heaved Jeff off his feet. He sprawled across the deck, then twisted in time to avoid another claw slamming into the deck. Saliva sprayed from the sentinel's mouth as its spiked tail twitched. With a screech, the sentinel whipped its tail at Jeff. He rolled out of the way. The resulting shockwave threw him sideways. He started to crab crawl away from the raking claws of the beast. Again, the massive claws came flying toward him. He tried to scramble away. This time he wouldn't be fast enough. The claws stabbed at him and he winced, bracing for the intense agony they would bring. Flashes of orange exploded from behind him. Pulse rounds crashed into the sentinel's face and leg. The alien's focus was thrown for a brief second. Jeff used that moment to pick himself up and sprint away. Now the sentinel rushed toward David.
"Jeff!" David cried. "Help me out!"
David ran behind one of the charred rhinos. Jeff leveled a blast of fire at the sentinel. The beast looked between the two boys as if deciding which would make easier prey. Jeff was determined neither of them would. He tossed an EMP grenade under the alien. The grenade went off with a blast that dissipated the sentinel's shield. The alien stumbled, crumpling forward on his front legs.
"Take it out now!"
Jeff yelled. They concentrated their fire on the creature's face. Rounds blasted into its eyes and mouth, tearing away at its flesh and armor. The monstrous alien still charged forward, bleeding and snarling.
"Run!"
Jeff said. He led David away through the mangled wreckage of a helicopter. The sentinel slammed into the ruined aircraft and knocked it away. The chopper smashed against a bulkhead, leaving a crater before falling to the deck. Shrieks called out from other corridors, and Jeff heard the screech, scratch of spiders descending on their position. They might be able to handle the sentinel, but trying to take him out while battling a dozen spiders didn't seem possible, no matter how good a job Bauma had done training them.
"We gotta stop it,"
David said as the sentinel plowed through a broken rhino. The alien pounded the vehicle into scrap metal. Blue blood oozed over the sentinel's face. It couldn't be long for this life, not with wounds like that. Jeff just needed another opportunity to fire on it, but they were too busy running and hiding to get a good shot. The sentinel let out another ear-splitting scream.
"David, you keep running,"
Jeff said.
"I'll kill him."
"But there's no time,"
Jeff said. "Just do it."
David scrambled between more burned husks of rhinos and choppers. Jeff climbed to the top of a rhino that lay on its side and aimed at the sentinel. He expected the beast to charge at him now that he was in the open. Instead, the sentinel went straight for David.
"No, you don't, you ugly bastard!"
Jeff unleashed a flurry of rounds into the side of the sentinel's face. Pops of blood and flesh flew with each impact. The sentinel suddenly switched direction. Its momentum carried it forward as its claws scratched the metal deck, fighting for purchase. Jeff's rifle clicked. Empty. The sentinel roared, then barreled toward him, its mouth wide open. Jeff's fingers trembled. He reached for a fresh magazine. All the while, more spider voices carried in from the corridors. Jeff almost lost his grip on the magazine. The sentinel drew ever closer. With a satisfying clink of metal against metal, the magazine found home.
The sentinel roared as Jeff sent a fusillade of fire into its terrifying maw. He didn't stop firing until the magazine was empty. To his relief, the fire left the sentinel's eyes. The beast crashed onto its side, jaw frozen open. Inertia carried it forward, bouncing and slamming against the vehicles in its path.